Welcome to the Plain Label Podcast, Pod Shots.
If we bring your mother back now, it will only be for one day, and then you will never be able to see her again.
Maybe she will be special. Maybe she will stay.
I thought this would be hard for you to understand. You were created to be so young.
Maybe the one day will be like that one day inside the amphibicopter. Maybe it will last forever.
David, you are the enduring memory of the human race. The most lasting proof of their genius. We only want for your happiness. David, you've had so little of that.
If you want for my happiness, then you know what you have to do.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Podshots. I'm your host, Eric Williams. For this episode, we are discussing the 2001 film AI, Artificial Intelligence, based on the short story Super Toys Last All Summer Long by Brian Aldiss. The film was written by Ian Watson and Steven Spielberg, who also directed the film. Here to discuss the film with me is returning guest, Mr. Sean Stangland.
Hello, I made it off the island in one piece. Hopefully everybody out there made it off too.
That's right. That's right. And if you're not clued into what Sean's mentioning, as of recording, we just recently released our 12-hour long episode of Lost.
I wasn't sure if it was going to be that long. I thought, well, he had to get it down to like 10. And then I saw the file, like, oh my God, 12 yeah. hours and 10 minutes.
And that's shaving probably a good 2 hours of meandering discussion. So that, if there's ever been a crisp 12 hours, there it was.
Yeah, no one could ever accuse us of not having passion for Lost.
That's true. That's true. Before getting into this discussion, I would like to mention that this podcast is brought to you by the Deliberate Noise Network. Head over to deliberatenoise.com and check out some of the other shows that are over there. So drink roll call time, Mr. Stanglin. What do you have for me?
All right. I am drinking the Alpha Claws, which is a Christmas porter from Three Floyds Brewing in Munster, Indiana, which is pretty much the big brewery up here other than Revolution. I made a little trip out across the border the other day, and they are the same people that make the Zombie Dust IPA, which is considered one of the best beers in the world, but that's never available for take-home sale. So I settled on the Christmas Porter. It's got some milk chocolate in it. It's got some Mexican sugar. It is a considerable brew.
I see. Yeah, I know that the Zombie Dust is one that you are very high on.
Yeah, we had it on tap with our lunch out there. It's just this little, it's an industrial park in Munster, Indiana, and it's just in a building that you can tell used to be just like an office park building, but they have a brewery and they have a tap room and they have good pork dish for lunch, and the zombie dust was flowing.
Nice. I'm going with something that is a little bit of a nod to Mr. Spielberg.
Oh.
And not in a dig, I guess.
Wait, is it Land Shark? No.
No, that would have worked too. That would have been good. I am going with a very sugary, sweet grapefruit vodka.
Ah, I see.
And we'll get into why I'm having that specifically. So with that, we can begin our discussion on the 2001 film AI.
When's your birthday? I never had a birthday.
His name is David.
I feel it.
That's creepy.
Whoa. That's so real.
In a distant future, in an age of intelligent machines, he is the first robotic child programmed to love and coexist as a member of a family. His is a tale of humanity and a journey to find his place among humans and machines.
I'm a boy.
You
least as real as I've ever made one.
And the IMDb plot synopsis is, this was a troubling one because there's about five or six over at IMDb, and none of them I'm really too satisfied with. And for the Podshot episodes, I've been trying to be a little more positive on the IMDb reviews, and this is the one that I found that I liked the most. So here we go. In the future, artificial intelligence has evolved in such a way that a family can now accept a near-to-lifelike child. This is exactly what the Swinton family does, but when things get worse for their relationship between the family and this new child, they send it out to survive on its own. With only the name David and a passion to become a real boy, the child becomes friends with Gigolo Joe and sets off to make it become a reality. And so it doesn't specifically say it. That's not very well written. As a future English teacher, I would make him revise, edit and revise. Isn't that right, Sean? You know what that's
about. Right.
So before getting into actually our notes and general comments about the film, tell me about your history with AI. And I guess that can sort of, begin with a little bit of, its creator, its director and writer.
Yes. Well, Spielberg, I mean, I grew up on the movies of Spielberg and I've always been a big Spielberg fan.
A big fan.
Well, yes, probably Jaws and Close Encounters are permanent fixtures in my top 10 of all time. This movie skirts with the top 10. Mm. I love Raiders. I love Temple of Doom. Curiously, I have never made it through War Horse yet. I just can't. It puts me to sleep, that movie. But anything else Spielberg does, I am there with bells on opening day.
What do you how do you feel about Tintin and Munich?
Tintin doesn't even feel like a Spielberg movie to me, quite honestly. It's a movie by committee and it feels like it. And, you know, it was a curiosity because he's never done an animated film before and it's performance capture. So he might even argue whether it's animated or not. But I think that film's more of a curiosity itself than anything else. Mm-hmm. Munich, I just saw again a few weeks ago and I was kind of knocked out by it. A lot of people have quibbles with the ending, but then again, a lot of people have quibbles with the ending of just about every Spielberg movie.
Yes, they do. Yes.
But the skill of filmmaking is unquestionable. And as an actor showcase, I mean, you've got Daniel Craig just before he became James Bond. You've got Eric Bana in probably his best role for sure.
Yes.
And all these great character actors.
Outside of Star Trek.
Oh, yeah. outside of Star Trek, where he seems to be giving three different performances according to what scene you're watching.
Screams fire everything. That's the only thing I remember about that performance.
Exactly. But and my relationship with this movie goes back even way before it even came out. I remember reading about this project in either a premiere or a Starlog. Do you know Starlog magazine?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Which, you know, would mean I was reading it at my local library in a Starlog magazine about how Stanley Kubrick wanted to make this movie about a robot boy, but that he didn't think visual effects were there yet.
Right, yeah.
And then Jurassic Park came out and that changed the game. And the story that has famously been recycled by Spielberg many times goes that he and Kubrick were corresponding by fax machine for years.
Direct fax.
Yes, a fax. Exactly. And that Kubrick always thought that it was more attuned to Spielberg's sensibilities. Mm-hmm. So this was a project the two of them had been working on, if not in close collaboration, like actually like building sets and anything like that, but a movie that had been talked about and I can't even talk today. You can just edit all this out.
Oh, that's fine. That's fine.
Apparently I've been drinking all day. No. This is a movie that was in a long pre-production phase,
right, yeah,
and a long theoretical phase. And it finally came to be. Unfortunately, it was 2 years after Kubrick died.
Right. You know, what's interesting is we're in kind of a funny time with this film and the schedule on Plain Label because we recently did Eyes Wide Shut as a recording, which is Kubrick's last film. And then we are going to record in about a couple of weeks. We'll be recording an episode on Munich.
Oh, there you go.
And so it's kind of funny that this will be coming out, you know, in between those two films. So it's a little bit of a handoff there in some ways, I guess.
But we're building a bridge.
That's right. But what's interesting about this film for me is I'd always sort of heard of it and heard about it kind of, you know, like the grumblings about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, you know, in 2001, you know, I liked movies fine. I watched a lot of movies, but it's not to the point of now or when I did the movie a day challenge. And it was when I was doing that, when I was doing a movie a day is when I came across this. And so that's 2011, I think. And, it was later on in the process. Like, I want to say it was around this time of the year. So I was in the 300s. And I came across it and I was like, I don't know, AI, like I'd heard so many sort of middling reviews, like not a lot of people that just outright hated it, like hated it with a passion, but were just kind of like, I don't know, it's kind of boring. Like it doesn't really do much for me. And I had always heard of, knew enough about it to know that it was a collaboration of sorts between the two filmmakers. And I was like, wow, that's interesting just in and of itself. And so it was one of those movies to where I knew that it was long. I knew that with the filmmakers attached, that it wasn't going to be just like a sit down and forget about it as soon as it's over kind of a film.
Yeah, no way.
Yeah. So it's a real meal of a film. And sometimes for me, I have to be in the right headspace for it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's kind of another little trend that we've been doing is a lot of films to where you can't just pop it on and watch it and have a good time with it. It's, you know, you kind of have to invest a little bit more. And while I think that that's a lot of fun, it's not an everyday watch kind of a film.
No. And so, I do wonder,
go ahead.
I was going to say, I do wonder if this movie hadn't have come out on June 29th in the thick of summer movie season, if maybe opinions on it would have been a little different.
Yeah. And that's, you know, and that's interesting. I mean, we can just get into this now. It came out in 2001 in the summer, right?
Yes.
So obviously 9/11 happens not too long after it had come out. And, you know, there's trade centers in the future that are shown. And there's the whole debate on whether they should keep that or not. And, you know, it's one of those things to where, If a film comes out in 2001 around this time, there is always going to be the cloud of 9/11 around it, I feel like. Not necessarily in terms of if it made money or not, but like people's reactions to it.
Right.
In retrospect and at the, you know, not necessarily directly when it came out, but looking back on it, it's like, oh, well, you know, my thoughts of those times sort of bleed into what I think of the movie in retrospect.
Yeah, I remember the first movie I saw after 9/11 in the theater was Zoolander, which there's a shot in that movie during the funeral for his four model buddies where he's giving the yugugli. There's a shot where they had to digitally take out the towers. And that's such a strange thing to have to worry about in what is one of the goofiest comedies imaginable. And it just really did kind of cast a pall over the whole movie to the point where I didn't like it. And then years later on cable, I laughed my ass off at it. Mm-hmm. And you know, 9/11 does have far reaching on a lot. It affects a lot of movies. Like, I don't think I've ever watched Fight Club all the way through since 9/11 happened.
Oh, interesting. Because
it seems like after that happened, I was like, can I even watch and enjoy Fight Club anymore? It's like, even if I completely abhor what Project Mayhem is doing, there is a bit of, you know, you kind of go along with the ride of it because you like the energy of the filmmaking and you start to like the characters even though they're doing these horrible things.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been wanting to revisit Fight Club lately after Gone Girl to kind of take a referendum on all of Fincher's stuff, but I don't know. It's a hard one for me to go back to.
You know what's interesting about Fight Club is that I think that people like that movie a lot more than they really do.
Hmm.
And I say that, and I don't mean people like us or people like the listeners of this podcast. I mean like your average Joe guy.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, and the reason it made me think of this is, you know, Chicago is much more in line with this, but we have some real interesting characters on sports talk radio. And we have, you know, most of them are like former Huskers or whatever. And,
right.
And we have a guy, and he was talking about Dumb and Dumber with the sequel coming out, and one of the other guys hadn't seen the first film, and he's like, oh, you know, that's one of my favorite movies of all time. But if I had to list my favorite movie of all time, it'd be Fight Club, because I just love the idea of guys kicking each other's asses and, you know, and just like not understanding the point of the film at all.
Yeah. And I do kind of wonder if maybe when I was 20, when the movie came out, if I didn't fully get the point either.
Yeah. And so, you know, they're just like, yeah, you know, they're kicking their ass and you know, and I'm like, oh my God, that's like, that's not what it's about, guy. Like, you know, and it just is such a, if you look at it in a certain way, it's such a meathead sort of a film to where you got Brad Pitt and his shirt's off and he's all bloody and blah, blah, blah. And you're,
right.
But, you know, and it's cool because it turns out it's the same guy and, you know, and that just really is, I turned up, you know, I was listening to pop radio after that. I was like, oh my God, I can't even handle listening to radio personalities talk about movies. But yeah, so I mean, it's kind of interesting when you look back at films, depending on the time when they came out, what your viewpoint of them.
Well, and it's further proof that your opinion on a movie is an evolving thing. Mm-hmm. It's not even, I remember Roger Ebert's review of Fight Club. He gave it 2 stars, and the most of the basis for why he gave it a bad review was because he thought people would take it the wrong way. And I was like, well, is that really the fault of the film? And I wonder if that is one that if he would have written a different review. I don't think that's one that he revisited. He revisited a lot of movies, but they were mostly movies that he liked anyway. But anyway.
Yeah, speaking of films that people have revisited.
Yes.
One of the very negative reviews I saw about AI was it's on the wiki page, which means it's never wrong. And one of the critics had said, you know, that it was Spielberg's first boring film.
Wow.
And really kind of, you know, took it to task and then later revisited it and it apologized and said that it was Spielberg's enduring masterpiece.
I think that's an opinion that is going to be more and more popular as the years go on.
Yeah,
I really think this movie is the start of his most interesting run of movies as a filmmaker. You had this, then the next year was Minority Report and Catch Me If You Can. Mm-hmm. Then he made his trio of 9/11 movies, starting with a comedy in The Terminal and then War of the Worlds and Munich. That's an interesting run of films. He blew it all to shit with Crystal Skull, but I mean, it's hard to find 6 more interesting movies in a row in Spielberg's filmography.
Yeah, that is interesting. Hmm. Yeah, I mean, in my initial reaction to AI when I first had watched it, you know, and this was a time, like I said, where I'm watching a movie every day and I was reviewing it every day. And you know, at times I was being very harsh on films because I was just sick and tired of the same old thing. And I watched this and just was absolutely mesmerized. I just absolutely loved it. And I started looking around online and was really surprised at all of the sort of, you know, average to, oh, it was fine kind of reviews. And I was like, oh my God, like what? You know, and I started thinking about what it was that I got out of it that other people didn't, or what I was putting on it that other people didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was the space. Like, you know, I watched it 10 years after it was made and, you know, I didn't bring any baggage to it and I didn't bring anything other than the expectations of the filmmakers that were making it.
Yeah.
And I think that helps.
I think there was a big problem back then too of a lot of people not understanding the last 30 minutes of the movie.
Okay.
Like a fundamental misunderstanding over what those things are that wake up David.
Yeah, because it's robots.
It's robots, but I even when I first saw it, I assumed they were aliens.
Yes.
then you go back and you think about it and you're like, oh no, they look just like the statue that's in the first shot of the movie. Yes. After the prologue with the waves. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it makes thematically, it makes more sense. But I mean, they had to know what they were doing because they also have the same basic shape as, like, you know, the stereotypical gray alien.
Yes.
So they had to know that confusion was worth it, that it would make audiences talk. And I think, you know, in 2001, yes, there was an internet culture, but it wasn't as pervasive as it is now. And I think that if this movie had come out now, the people who didn't understand that would have been set right, like, the next day. Sure. On the internet.
It'd have been, oh, no, it's not aliens, it's robots. Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I do think that fundamental misunderstanding kind of colors a lot of people's opinions on the movie.
Yeah, so getting into my notes here, you know what I really like is we have Ben Kingsley who does the narration.
And, yes.
You know, it's like that commercial where you just get British people to do your narration and be your bad guys, right? But I was like, oh, God, he's so good. But I love this opening explanation of how this future's gone bad in ways. Mm-hmm. You know, and I was like, and, you know, I basically had called it a premonition ? Hmm. You know, because it's talking about, well, we have the climate change and we have this and that and the other. And I'm like, Jesus, this is 13 years ago, you know, and it's you know, wasn't quite as in vogue, I don't think, as it has been after Inconvenient Truth. And
yeah, this predates that by 3 years. Was that 2004?
That sounds right. Yeah. Somewhere around there, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
But I was like, oh, that's interesting. And I like that. And, you know, I found myself in this, watching this film this time, being pretty sparse with the notes. And that usually only happens, you know, I've mentioned this before when we talked about Lost, it usually only happens when I'm really invested.
Mm-hmm.
When a film really sort of has me, and then when it cuts and goes to a new scene, I'm like, oh shit, I gotta write that down. Like, like, oh, I forgot. But one of the things that I really like is that, I mean, you know, I have notes like I really like John Hurt or William Hurt and, that sort of thing. But I think that, the Kubrick design of things.
Mm.
And it struck me as a Kubrick design and a Spielbergian characters in a Kubrick designed film.
Hmm.
Is what it looked like to me. Because there were some shots, whether it's like his, whether it's bedrooms or bathrooms. Or...
Yeah, that I don't know if it's egg shaped. Mm-hmm. Or like almost like a snail shell with the blue lights going around it. That's quite a striking piece of set design.
Yeah, there's a few things to where I'm like, ooh, that just looks like something that I would see in, you know, 2001 or in mm-hmm. some sort of Kubrick production. And, you know, we recently did The Shining. We recently did Eyes Wide Shut, like I said, and we're doing A Clockwork Orange that I rewatched recently. So all of those are kind of fresh in my mind mm-hmm. as I'm watching it, at least more fresh than normally they would have been. And then, you know, even though he refutes it and says, you know, no, this is not the case, it has very striking Spielberg type moments in the film. With the characters and with the ending and with the begin, you know, it's that beginning and the end, which people always say, oh, well, that's so Spielberg. That's so saccharine. That's just, you know, too sweet to be real.
Yeah.
And then you have the middle sort of, dirty and look how terrible humanity is and look at the depths we've sunk to and that's sort of traditionally thought of as the Kubrick point of view. And, you know, Spielberg has said and is very adamant about, no, I'm responsible for the middle. It's Kubrick it's basically from his notes or whatever, the beginning and the end. And, so I don't know, because, you know, some people have said, well, that's why he said Spielberg should direct it, because he couldn't make the ending work because it was too sweet. You know, and that's why he felt like Spielberg would be able to handle it. So I don't know. I mean, I kind of struggle with that because I feel like it's almost, you know, I don't think you're going to like this, but it's almost like It's almost like a J.J. Abrams sort of thing if it's not Spielberg doing it. You know what I mean? Like, it's so close to Spielberg in ways.
Oh, okay, I see what you mean.
If it wasn't on purpose, it's so close to something that he would typically do, to where I think that's why people feel that way.
See, and for me, the specter of Kubrick is all over this movie.
Okay.
Like, even the parts that I think people, like you were saying, the saccharine parts, it all has this foreboding to me.
Uh-huh.
And I don't, you know, a lot of people think the ending is this uplifting, happy thing, and it devastates me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, there was, you know what? And here's a little peek behind the curtain, and it's not a real flattering one, but I want, you know, and Elle and I watched this, and we watched this on, we watched the end on the night that the Lost podcast came out. Okay. And so we watched the end, and it's this, you know, sort of exhale as the film ends. And, you know, you have the John Williams score playing, who's tremendous, of course. And I said, you know what? Here, hold on a second. And I go grab my phone and I put on the end of the Lost podcast. Right?
Uh-huh.
And as good as John Williams is, that because of what the ending of that podcast and that song choice meant to the two of us,
mm-hmm.
with that piece of music by Giacchino, it absolutely tore us both up.
Wow.
And we're sitting there and we're sort of like talking and thinking about the end of the film, and we're listening to the song, and then we're just kind of listening to it for a while. And it was hard, you know, to think about the film. And it was one of those things where you're upset, but you don't know if you know exactly why.
Yes.
You know?
And, well, I mean, we don't take on the light airy movies, do we? I mean, this movie it's a quest for religion, ultimately, is what this movie is. Mm-hmm. And
who better to talk about it than you and I?
Well, I know, apparently. And I just, I mean, the end of this movie, I didn't think we would get into the ending already, but what the hell? Here we go.
Sure, go ahead. Well, we're all over the place this time.
Well, yeah, the ending of this movie is predicated on what David wants.
Mm-hmm.
The robot, the Ben Kingsley robot, the head of the robot, says give him what he wants.
Mm-hmm.
And we could argue forever and ever whether we really think Monica ever loved David. And for the longest time, I was convinced no way. She didn't love him. She loved the idea of him. When she's torn up about leaving him in the woods, she's mm-hmm. just more horrified at what she's doing
mm-hmm.
and for herself, and not really that she's leaving him. So for years, I was adamant that no, this is like, this movie proves that we're all suckers.
Mm.
David dies thinking that he is loved by his mother, just like we all die thinking God's going to love us. Mm-hmm. And, but it's all a lie. And I was convinced that was the only way to read the movie, and that, you know, the photography and the John Williams music, that's all a lie. But, you know, that for years I said that just because I wanted to believe so hard that I was right about the movie. But you can't be right about a movie like this. This is a movie from start to finish that can be read so many different ways. It's so nuanced. This is Spielberg's most exciting movie to me, just because it's dripping with ideas and with morality questions and with subtext. And I don't know if these people really loved that kid. Mm. And I've seen this movie like 20 times.
Mm-hmm.
And I still can't figure out for myself if Monica really loved David.
Sure. I think my initial takeaway is the same as yours.
Ah.
You know, my initial takeaway is, you know, he is a child who wants what he wants, just like how, you know, we're wanting to be shepherded,
mm-hmm.
you know, into believing a certain way, and, oh, everything's going to be nice and rosy and everything's going to be fine.
Yep.
Right. But then you step back and you're like, actually, no, it's not.
Well, and then
if that makes you sleep well, great.
Yeah. But what does it do for Teddy? That's the thing that really kills
That's
me.
That's what really fucks you up, right?
Is that Teddy's just sitting on the bed like, well, fuck, what do I do?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, Teddy's treated as a second-class citizen by David almost immediately. Because there's that part where he makes those drawings, and he's got parts where he's written out little notes to Monica. Mm-hmm. And he said, and like David says that his brother is real, I am real, but Teddy is not, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Teddy's a robot just like David, and he can talk and he seems to know what's going on, but he's just a bear.
He doesn't have the, maybe it's because he doesn't have the ability to love like David.
Right. But it's just kind of
lesser.
It's like even David learns right away that, you know, he learns that bit of, I don't know if it's I guess it is a kind of a dehumanizing thing. Like David learns that he is special.
Mm-hmm.
Even, you know.
Well, what it is, Sean, is David is a Christian. His name's David.
Yes. Right?
And Teddy is an atheist or a non-believer.
Hmm.
So he's lesser.
He might
because he doesn't have the capacity to believe what David believes.
Right.
In love.
That is one way to look
right?
at it.
So there you go. That was just off the cuff. I don't know. The Teddy thing I completely forgot.
You're in the right place on that though.
So there you go. Okay. I want to go back and talk about the beginning.
Yeah. Yes.
I want to talk about the introduction of David into this family life,
mm-hmm.
and the sort of awkwardness that the mother has at the beginning, and the sort of, I shouldn't love this thing. I shouldn't allow this thing to love me. But she's so, now you can say selfish,
yes.
Needy. I mean, you could put a ton of different labels on her. But ultimately, you know, and it's a terrible thing. I mean, if you look at it in a way to where she makes this thing programmed into loving her and only her and never stopping and, you know, on this never ending quest to reclaim her love and all of this. And she, you know, I'm glad that they never went back to her, but I could see in 3, 6, 9 months that she's like, oh, okay, well, Martin, let's just go about our day and my real son's here.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and that struck me very much as almost a, you know, and this is again is reading into it because of my situation, but that struck me as conversations that Anel and I have had about having a child and having our child and me not treating our child and Anna's, who would be my, you know, my stepdaughter.
Right.
And treating those two kids differently.
Hmm.
You know, to where you have your quote unquote real one. And then this other one that you're just kind of have.
Yeah.
You know, and making sure that there's no difference. And since that one that she's just decided to have is disposable, she could just get rid of it.
Oof.
You know?
Well, and something I had never considered before watching it this time was that I wonder if how the society is structured as the prologue sets up, where they have to be licensed to have
mm-hmm,
kids.
Mm-hmm.
If that kind of means that there's a lack of intimacy altogether, because if you watch Monica and her husband, whose name escapes me right now, cause he's such a lightweight.
Oh, he is.
I think the note I have on him is that he's a stupid asshole, I think is what I put. But,
yeah, it's Henry Swinton.
That's right, Henry.
Sam Robards is the guy.
Yes. So, I mean, they don't seem particularly close. There's no suggestion that these people, you know, have a sex life of kind.
No, they are very sterile. And that's another thing that made me think of Kubrick, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, and even like the opening scene has all these, professorial looking people in this beautiful study, basically talking about taking the next step from making fuckbots.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah, you know, all these, like this room of the smartest people in the world, which includes two Lost cast members and Agent Coulson.
Yes.
you know, the smartest people in the world are all working on making fuckbots. Mm-hmm. And I think the movie kind of hints at that might be the only way anybody's getting any in this society.
Oh, yeah, because you have... You know, she seemed like she's the classy one, right?
Yeah.
And I don't think it's an accident that it's the key is open your mouth. You know, and she opens her mouth, and then he puts his finger like up in the roof of her mouth.
Yeah, and he like just casually says undress, and yes. It's like kind of, it's very strange.
That's, I mean, that struck me this time. I was like, wow, like what, you know, it couldn't be like up at her eyes where the thing splits. It had to be in her mouth.
Yeah.
Like, that had to have been on purpose.
Absolutely.
But yeah, you know, I thought that was interesting too, that it was, you know, Gigolo Joe was apparently the, you know, less affordable version of the thing that they had in the, with this professor, you know?
Yeah.
Professor Poppy, just, I guess is his name.
Yeah, it just strikes me, I think the Kubrick movie that this reminds me the most of throughout is Clockwork Orange, which may stand to reason because it's kind of it's probably set in the same time period, mm-hmm. you know, more or less, and it's a dystopian science fiction thing, but kind of the in Clockwork Orange where you have all the doctors and professors performing the experiments on him, and you know, at the very end where he has sex with those women, and mm-hmm. but it's intercut with the hospital. It just struck me as the same kind of thing in the opening where you have all these sterile, smart people whose goal is to make sex robots.
Yeah. Ugh. What a world. What a world.
Yeah.
Yeah. With the introduction though, and of the sort of family dynamic changing, I do want to mention, and I think that this kid has, I don't know, maybe a bad reputation now, but
yeah.
Haley Joel Osment is terrific in this.
It's incredible. It's an incredible performance. Oh.
Every time, I haven't seen it 20 times. This is probably like 3 or 4.
Yeah.
But every time I see it, I forget how good he is. And I watch it again because when I think of the movie, the machines being, or the mechas being like Jude Law,
mm-hmm.
to where he is a machine, but he's still, you know, like they said in the notes on IMDb, to where he's trying to do like a Fred Astaire sort of a thing, right? Like mm-hmm. He's just light on his feet and really fluid, but he looks like he's a robot because he's got the extra prosthetics and extra shiny and extra fake looking.
Right.
And Osment has got the little, like, he looks not real, but he looks real, and it's just such a fine line that they go back and forth on, and it's very disturbing and very, very well done. And I love the fact that, you know, he came to Spielberg allegedly with the idea of not blinking in any of his cuts, in any of his scenes, so he doesn't blink, which is supposed to add to the other element of it all. And that's not something that I really picked up on, like, I don't watch a scene thinking, oh, has he blinked or not?
You
know?
Yeah.
But after, you know, reading that note, I'm like, oh, okay, well, I can think of these different scenes, and I don't know that I know it well enough to know that he did blink, but damn, that's crazy if he doesn't.
Well, yeah, and, you know, there's so many Spielberg movies that have the infamous Spielberg gawk, you know, the gaze, I guess, where characters are kind of unblinkingly staring into nothingness, you know, gasping at something that it's a thing you've seen in Spielberg before, but I mean, it is definitely, when you go back and watch it, you know, that it's very unsettling.
Yeah.
It adds to the whole tone of the movie. And I mean, obviously, Haley Joel was skilled because Sixth Sense was before this,
yeah.
and that was working for a guy who we found out was not a good director.
Yeah, after those bag of tricks were, we're like, oh.
But you watch this.
Oh, boy.
Well, yeah. But you watch this and you consider, like, how natural the kids' performances are in E.T.
Mm.
And I mean, if Spielberg doesn't direct kids better than anybody else, I don't know who does. I mean,
well, George Lucas, clearly.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
I'm kidding.
But, and it would make perfect sense that Spielberg would be the director who, still in his 60s, could make a connection with kids.
Sure.
Yeah. You just look at his body of work. You know, maybe it didn't work in Hook, but,
yeah.
But it sure works here, and it works in E.T. I mean, it's just, it's a remarkable performance.
Yeah.
And it didn't get the credit, I think, because I think people are kind of, kind of shy away from praising a kid actor more than once because they don't want to think it's kind of gimmicky, I guess. And plus, this would have been in the best actor. This is not a supporting performance.
Right, yeah.
But, I mean, this is one of the best performances of the century, which sounds lofty, but, you know, we're only in 2014.
Sure. Sure. Yeah, so, I mean, I thought he was... He was very, very good, and the sequences that I liked him the most were the first one is the phone call that he gets.
Yeah, that's some creepy shit.
Yes, and that's the one where I'm like, oh, okay, this is a Kubrick thing, you know, to where it's got that darker tone, and it's not like Spielberg can't do dark. I mean, he did fucking Jaws, for Christ's sake.
Right.
You know, so it's not like he only does light uplifting films or something, which I think is his reputation. I don't know. But it's that sequence where, you know, he's impersonating his, surrogate father's voice when he's talking to his would-be mother. And then the other one is the pool scene, is the birthday party.
Right. Got all kinds of creepy stuff going on in it.
Shit. Like that is, when I first watched it, that's when I was like, oh my God, like I was completely invested. To where, you know, I didn't, you know, they had already had this sort of sibling rivalry with him eating shit that he wasn't supposed to eat.
Right.
And, you know, his face was all droopy and this is the part where little asshole boys are being little asshole boys. And, you know, they're picking on him and he's just trying to get help from his jerk ass of a brother, Martin, and who is so good at being a little dickhead. I was, you know, this time watching it, I was like, oh, well done. Like, you're just making me hate this little kid. And, you know, it's the pulling him into the pool. You know, it's the fight or flight and he's trying to get away and he doesn't really understand that he's going to drown his brother. Or maybe does he, you know, I don't think that he does, but I think you could say, well, you know, he's not really a real fan of this kid.
So, do you mean like, do you think that it's possible he might have killed his brother?
No, I mean, I don't think that he was trying to, but I think that if you're a real cynic, you could be like, well, you know, he did just make him eat that spinach and, you know, he's not the greatest of kids, but no. I don't think that he's trying to do that. No. But yeah, I mean, there's that sequence and him just being under the pool and just sitting there with his arms outstretched.
And, which is it's a beautiful image and it's a beautiful bit of foreshadowing too.
Yes. Oh yes. And that really just struck me as, you know, I didn't have any idea where the film was going at that point. You know?
Yeah. I think I said on Twitter the other night that the first 50 minutes of this movie are basically Spielberg and his, director of photography, Janusz Kaminski, showing that they're better filmmakers than everybody. Right. I mean, it's just the first act of this film is just, it's perfect. It's for what it needs to do and for the dynamic that it sets up and the sense of foreboding, but also kind of the, you know, it also sets up this family life that you enjoy. You're rooting for them to accept him for everything that they set out to do. It's perfect.
Yeah.
And the photography, the choice to do this kind of gauzy but also grainy, like dreamlike photography is a great choice.
Sure.
And then there's the hide and seek sequence.
Yes.
Which is like the first time we get David at home with Monica just by themselves.
Yeah, that's the fall in love with this kid. Please
love him. And that's also where John Williams comes into play in a big way.
Yes.
Where he's got kind of this traditional John Williams melodic full orchestra melody going for Monica. And then when David counters with something, it turns into this like kind of almost like a robotic music box sound where it's kind of cutesy, but also off-putting and synthetic all at once. And it's like a perfect little interplay of the music to help sell the theme of what you're watching.
Yeah, it was strange to me. I don't know. I kept thinking about that musical choice when it goes from, you know, sort of like your organic people to your synthetic people.
Mm-hmm.
And it did seem like it's either the same sort of thing just through a synthesizer or it's like at a different, pace or a different measure or something, a different, you know, I don't know the musical terms properly, but right. You know, it just seemed like a slightly different version of something that's sort of similar. And it was like just put you on edge a little bit.
Yeah, he does a lot of stuff in this movie that's kind of similar to Philip Glass's music, where it's very repetitive and almost mathematical. But with Williams flourishes, and it's not a completely successful score, because I think when he does the sort of techno stuff, like in the Rouge City part,
yes,
there's the chase with there's a motorcycle chase, and then there's the getaway in the helicopter, and he does like this really bad techno beat. And it's like, no, it's okay, John Williams. You don't have to do that. It's like, you don't have to do everything better than everybody else. It's okay that you can't do techno, but it is.
Just let the Tron movies handle that.
Yeah, exactly. So that doesn't quite work. But then, you know, the quoting of the Strauss piece when going into Rouge City, which was the only thing that Kubrick asked for in the music.
Right. Yeah.
That works, and the theme at the end is gorgeous. I could leave the vocal version that's on the album, and thankfully is not in the movie at all. There's words to that song.
Ooh, I don't know that.
Yeah, it was sang by Canadian songstress Lara Fabian, called For Always. Well, don't look that up. It's terrible.
that would not be the song that takes us out.
Yeah, you don't need the love theme from AI.
Well, let's talk about, you mentioned the middle bit with the techno.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about where I think a lot of the confusion and the, wait a minute, this isn't, what's going on with this movie now? I think a lot of that comes with the introduction of Gigolo Joe and the sort of quest that begins. Because I think that part of a lot of people's struggle would stem with that first 50 minutes. Everyone's well into the family drama, and oh my God, is he going to be a part of this family or not? And this kid's so terrible, and he almost drowned him, and now that she's trying to abandon him. And then it turns into a completely different movie.
Yeah.
And you realize,
which was exciting to see the first time.
And you realize that it's not about the family anymore, that it's about this world. And I think that there are, like you were mentioning earlier about Spielberg and there being so many different things about this film. I think that's the only struggle that I have, is there are so many things where it is so packed in, to where sometimes I'm like, oh God, give me more of this. Like, I want more of this now.
Yeah.
You know, and you just kind of get touches of it. But there are points to it that I don't know in the amount of time that's given that I think it's fully successful. And so that's the only parts that are a little troubling to me is the Flesh Fair and the Rouge City stuff.
Which, and the Flesh Fair to me is the part of the movie that I flip-flop the most on. Because I think it's successful in what it wants to achieve narratively. But it does come off as kind of a, I don't know, what's the word I'm looking for? It comes off as something punk rock that was made by people that don't know what the hell punk rock is. Even though they got Ministry, the great Chicago industrial band, to come be the band at the Flesh Fair, it's like, it just, something about that seems a little off and too exaggerated for its own good. But the stuff in it that works is great. And Rouge City for me, I mean, that's the kind of thing where it makes such a big impression in such a short amount of time that I want to see more in that, in more movie in Rouge City. But I think that's part of why it works, is that it leaves you wanting more.
Okay. See, that's, I think, the only part that we really differ so far, is that that's the part I was talking about wanting more of it. Because I'm like, okay, well, I get that we're in this place that's, you know, like Atlantic City or Vegas or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
Depending on where you think they are and all that. But
well, I think it's Atlantic City, because it's supposed to be in New Jersey. I think they say it's in New Jersey.
Yeah, geographically, I think it would have to be. Yeah. So you have that, and I'm like, okay, great. It's in Atlantic City in the future, and it's all just obsessed with sex. And I heard I read about the huge penis that was digitally erased that was in there to keep the PG-13, you know, in the penis building, which I think is interesting.
Yeah, but all the other buildings are like, you know, really lurid depictions of the female body, but you gotta get rid of that penis.
Gotta get rid of that penis. I mean, if you want to see it, just drive by Lincoln, Nebraska. I mean, that's what it looks like. So, that's exactly what it is. So, you have that, and you have the Robin Williams, Dr. No stuff, and, that was the only sequence to where I'm like, well, I don't feel like this is lived in enough, because you do get the Gigolo Jane, and you get this sort of beginnings of a murder mystery or a frame job and all of that. But that goes away pretty quickly because
Spielberg gets to do a 2-minute film noir movie in the middle of his sci-fi opus.
Yeah. Cause you feel like, oh, okay, well, he's on the run and David's on the run, but then they're just kind of on the run. And it's not really like very specific. They're both just trying to go somewhere.
Yeah.
And then after a while you forget, you're like, oh, Gigolo Joe, why is he helping him? He's just a nice guy. He's a nice guy sex bot. It's just helping him out. And you're like, oh, wait, no, he's running from the cops, right?
Yeah. Well, and David basically chooses him at the flesh fair to be his.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. He, you know, grabs hold and.
Yeah.
That's when I think that. You know, again, I think that the unfortunate things in the Flesh Fair for me are the design of the people chasing them down with the hounds.
Yeah.
Those things strike me as, here's what the future looks like, and it's going to be crazy with all these jagged edges and, you know. All
that. Exactly.
And then we have the Chris Rock cameo it's fine because it's 3 seconds, but it's like, oh man, why is... This is so blatantly like, here's the famous comedian of 2001. We're going to
film. Yeah, that to me feels like one of those ideas that seemed like a good idea on paper. Where it was like, well, you know, the Meccas could create a famous dead comedian, recreate a famous dead comedian. And you could have Chris Rock live again in 20 whatever. Mm-hmm. But to actually put it in the movie, it takes you right out of the movie.
Well, it looks like him, and it looks like here's our funny little black man.
Yeah,
because everything else is white in the movie, and I'm like, I don't know about that part.
Yeah, it was a bit of a miscalculation. It makes me wonder if around the time they were making this, if Spielberg and Chris Rock had been trying to find a project to do together or had mutual friends.
Sure.
And it was just like, hey, you know what would be cool if we did this? Because I think Spielberg gets a lot of little flights of fancy like that. Mm-hmm. And nobody's going to tell Steven Spielberg no.
Yeah, he'll be like, you know who I am, right? We're doing this. Sorry.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, so then we get into the, what is it called? It's not called a helicopter. It's like an aquacopter.
The amphibicopter.
Amphibicopter, yes. Which is funny to me. But, we get into that, you know, and we get into New York and they're talking about finding the blue fairy, and it's the place where the lion's cry or something like that.
Yeah. In Manhattan.
Manhattan. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so we get in there and turns out that, you know, Professor Hobby's there and they've got all these different Davids, and that again is another whole 40-50 minute sequence that could have been that's chopped down to like 5 to 10 minutes. You know, that's another thing where I'm like, well, god damn, like that would that fuck with his program? What, you know, and he jumps out and they're just kind of like, all right, cool. See ya. Because that's all that you see of them. You don't see anyone else. You don't see Professor Hobby after that.
That's true. You know? Like you don't see, like how did David even get to be alone in that room? I forget now.
Yeah, I don't know.
It does seem weird that he would even have a chance to go off by himself at that point.
And
then you don't have the rest of the movie.
Sure. So. And they're in the, you know, they're in that building, and Elle said to me, she's like, well, how the fuck are they living in this place? She's like, it's all underwater. Like why are they here? And I was like, I don't know. It doesn't matter.
Because it's a fairy tale, so, you know, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah. I mean, and so it's one of those things to where I can see if you're not fully engrossed like I was, if you're not in the same headspace, you can be like, well, this, I don't, what is this? And what about this? Why are we doing this? You know, and you can pull at the strings a little, and you can start being that cynical, like, well, this doesn't make any sense. Humph.
Right.
You know?
Well, I think a lot of it, may hinge on whether you buy the whole fairy tale thing too. I mean, they tell you in no uncertain terms. It's like, if you don't get it 30 minutes in, then they have Martin give her Pinocchio to read.
Oh, yes.
You know, like when she first goes to visit Martin, when he's in like his cryo tube, she's reading him Robin Hood. The music she's playing is Tchaikovsky's Sleeping Beauty Waltz, which was then turned into the famous song from Sleeping Beauty, the Walt Disney animated film. There's all the fairy tale imagery on the wall in the children's hospital ward.
Yes.
So, yeah, it's like, hey, this is a fairy tale. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I could see where if you don't get on board with that you might just think the whole movie's a bunch of baloney, basically.
Sure. Or you can infuriate yourself by just asking why and trying to figure it out when it's not meant to be figured out like that.
No.
You know?
Yeah, I think there's always science fiction is tricky like that, where some people want it to be scientifically accurate 100%, and that's the reason why they like it. But then the other reason the reason I love sci-fi is that it uses the future to tell us about now.
Mm-hmm.
And to be a morality tale, or, you know.
Exactly.
And what sci-fi will always walk that line where it's like, well, where you got the plot hole complainers and then you've got the people who don't care about plot holes. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's exactly right. You know, so we get his, he goes down and he finds, you know, goes into Pinocchio and he finds the blue fairy and he's there. And I love that he is essentially stuck on a loop and continues to ask the same questions. And it's that he does it in a way, and this is another scene that really got me, because he does it in a way to where he's not frustrated. He's genuinely understanding why he's not getting what he's asking for, the way that he keeps asking to be turned into a real boy. And, you know, I've had, you know, Anna has said things like that to me. Like, she'll ask me for something and I'll either not hear her or whatever. And she'll kind of look at you and ask me again, like, wait, that's okay. Like, why are you not doing it? Like, what's going on? You know? And so I'm seeing him ask and it's like, oh my God, like, this is rough. This is tough for me to watch. And, you know, Teddy's sitting there and I can just see, you know, if it's a more cynical version of him, I could see him just like mumbling to himself, you know, like, oh, yeah. Jesus Christ. This is just for years and years, he's just saying the same things over and over and over. And then we have, you know, the Ferris wheel comes down and they're trapped, and we have the freeze.
And that's where a lot of people wish the movie would end.
Mm.
And I know when I saw it opening day and then that Ferris wheel came out, I'm like, oh shit, the movie's ending like this.
Mm.
But I'm glad it didn't.
No, me too, because
I
understand that that's, I guess, less challenging.
Yes.
If it just ends always searching for the thing that he wants.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if you go with the religious angle and you talk about him wanting his, you know, he's wanting to be loved and he's wanting to believe in his heaven.
Right.
And he doesn't get it.
Nope.
In that ending.
No.
And, you know, for me, you know, I'd be like, oh, fuck yeah, just leave him hanging.
Yeah. I mean, that's the super cynical ending. And a lot of, you know, and the assumption is that like we were talking about it before, that what happens after that was all Spielberg's creation to make a happy ending. But I've, you know, like I said, I've never agreed that it's a happy ending.
No, I think you're right. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's much more sad.
Yes, you know, it's absolutely it is.
The downbeat thing, you know, and that's what, you know, my note this time again is the same thing that I wrote last time, or the same thing that I thought last time I saw it, which was, I love the way that Spielberg, or, you know, Kubrick in the designs, or, you know, in the short story or whatever, I love the way that the film kind of closes down towards the end of the movie. Like, it's becoming very focused on David.
Yeah.
And then he's stuck there, and then it opens up much bigger than we'd seen before.
Yeah.
And it's like now the whole fucking world is frozen, or at least in this part of the world.
Yeah.
And we have this, you know, this, what many people think is an alien ship that's a robot that's flying around and it breaks apart, you know, and it's so symmetrical. That's why, you know, everything's little squares and stuff. I'm like, okay, well, it's machines. But, you know, we have this sequence where he's thawed out and the ferry breaks and he, you know, that's the only part where when he's completely frozen and he's first getting out of the thing, that's when I was like, oh, okay, I can see Haley Joel playing at being a robot here. To where the rest of the film, I was like completely invested where he's like getting out and like doing, it's like doing the robot almost.
Yeah. Where he's like twitching and stuff when they thaw him out. Yeah. That is, it's effective, but it is like the only time you're like, oh, he's doing the robot thing.
Yeah. And so, you know, they have this, they thaw him out basically to say, yeah, you know, we can't make it happen.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like, oh, damn. It's like, we're going to wake you up just to tell you the thing that you want, that's not happening.
Yeah. And then what they do end up doing, I'm not even really sure if they're telling him the truth there or if he's just going to be another specimen, you know, in their studies.
Oh, where they're talking about him being shut down, you mean? Or
where like, you know, is it true that they can only bring Monica back for one day? Oh. Is she actually coming back or is it all like there's a shot of all of the other mechas looking down at a screen that to me almost suggests that they're watching like a simulation that's going on. Like it's just programs running somewhere.
I guess I took that as it was like when they were sharing his memories. I guess that I took that as they were able to, like this was happening, but this was a way for them all to see it, I guess.
Right. And you could argue, yeah, I guess there's no real way to know if we're supposed to think that what is happening at the end is really happening or if it's just happening in a computer somewhere.
Or, yeah, I mean, they could have just switched his programming to where he's thinking it now.
Yeah, because, I mean, Teddy's there with the hair follicle, but where did the house come from?
Sure.
So that's, you know, like I've always kind of wondered, like, well, but then again, it's a fairy tale. And maybe I shouldn't get hung up on that.
and you know, I think that it's so nice that I just love the way that Spielberg plays with the audience in this last 15 minutes. You know, it's the house is there and they're like, well, you know, we can't do this. Sorry. And Teddy reveals the hair and you're like, oh, yes. It's going to work, you know, and you have this like uplifting feeling and then they tell you, oh, well, it's only for a day. So it's like he gives you the carrot, then he pulls it away.
Yeah.
You know, and then, and so then you're like, oh, okay, well, it's only one day, but it's the perfect day and everything's the best. And then he doesn't yank the rug out from under you, but then you are led to believe, oh, and everything was fine and they went to sleep and they just loved each other.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like, well, wait a minute.
Yeah. Wait a minute there. Yeah.
You know, if you're just going along with it, I just think that it all depends on your point of view. And that's what I think is so interesting about it.
Yeah. And I wrote a long piece about this movie online a few years ago, and I got taken to task by a commenter who was like, why does everything have to be about your beliefs, and you know, why do you have to force your atheist outlook on this movie? I'm like, because that's what the movie's about. Yeah. Like the whole movie is about the question of who we are and what happens to us after we die. And I mean, the best line of dialogue, the single best line of dialogue in the movie is when Gigolo Joe is getting, you know, is in the tractor.
Oh, yes.
And he looks right at Dave and goes, I am, I was.
Right.
And, you know, that kind of some, that, you know, it's kind of like only a being that is convinced there's nothing else for him would want to make sure that people remembered him. People who were alive remembered him. Like that's to me is such a self-centered thing to say. But I think that's what it comes out of. If something's going to happen to you after you die, then you're not as worried about the legacy that you
leave. Yeah, it'll be see you soon.
Yeah.
You know,
exactly.
We'll all, we'll all end up in this freaking in this Nirvana state together. Yeah,
exactly.
Where I mean, I think that that's great because he's saying he's directly saying there's nothing else.
Yeah.
You know, I was here. I did things. I existed. Mm-hmm. Don't forget. Is yep. essentially what he's saying, and he's saying that in four words. You know.
Yes.
And that's so good. It's, you know, he's a robot, and it's so specific and direct without spelling it all out.
And it's delivered in a moment that is just so, I mean, it's such an out of the ordinary moment. I mean, he's floating in midair and yeah. he delivers like the key line of dialogue in the entire movie.
Right.
You know, it's not like it happens in this, you know, important, intimate discussion. It's just the way that they pull that off. I mean, it's Spielberg.
Yeah, it's good. You know, people that say that he's a little too sugary sweet, which I was kidding about my drink of right. choice, was that, mm-hmm. Is that, you know, if he was, that would have been when they were, driving around in the copter together.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been when they were walking after, you know, escaping some imprisonment or, you know, some sort of danger.
Right, and David would have had a counter for it.
Yeah, he would have said something, and David would have, like, looked at him and gave that Spielberg gawk.
Yeah.
You know, or something. And it would have just been so rote and just so predictable.
Mm-hmm.
But the way that it's delivered here, and you're like, holy shit, that's the whole movie.
Yep.
That's it right there. And then with the whole, with the ending to where this is what he wants, so we're going to give it to him.
Yep.
You know, and people can read into that in many ways. It's like, well, here's what the film going audience wants. They think I'm giving them a happy ending, but I'm not.
Yeah.
They want.
I mean, and I think the music is probably the biggest thing in convincing you that it's supposed to be a happy ending.
Yes.
There's no hint of irony in the music in the final act, which is probably by design. And, you know, if you read interviews or watch the special features on the Blu-ray, everybody involved with the movie talks about it like it's this fairy tale with this sweet ending. And I don't know if I believe them. You know, I think they might all be taking marching orders. Hey, we're going to tell them that this is what the movie's about, but really we've got all this other shit going on.
Right, because wasn't this one of the films where they did not give them the entire script?
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, I believe
that would make sense.
I believe that Spielberg, I think I have this in my notes. I believe that he gave them, did not give them the entire script, and they had a disclosure form or whatever that they had to fill out that they wouldn't talk about certain things about it. And
well, you know, that makes sense. If you look back at the trailers for this movie, they don't tell you anything.
Mm.
Like the trailers on the Blu-ray anyway, they're basically teasers that have maybe one shot from the movie in them. And I was trying to think if I remember seeing a trailer that showed anything of the movie back then. And I don't think you could get away with, a multi-million dollar Spielberg movie not telling you anything about it in the trailers, but they really didn't. And, you know, it worked for the movie because, you know, like you could go through, like you said before, you could go through the first almost hour of this movie thinking that you know exactly what this movie is. And then, oh, here's a flesh fair.
Yeah, really. Interesting. Yeah, I don't know. I can't find it anywhere in here, but I'm almost positive that that's right, that he had them sign a non-disclosure agreement and that they did not have the entire script when they started shooting. And a lot of the times you see that now in big blockbuster films where it's like, oh, yeah, 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 we'll just fill in the dialogue later. I don't believe that that's the case here, but.
No, yeah, like when you hear stories like that about like something like, say, Captain America: The Winter Soldier, you don't know if that's because they want to keep it a secret from the fans who are trying to find out everything, or it's just that's what they can tell you they're doing when really the fact is they don't have the script finished
yet. Yeah, or you see like a Transformers film, or like a Star Trek Into Darkness or something like that.
That was the movie with the most amount of secrecy for no reason.
Yeah.
I mean, I appreciate that it's they're Khan. Trying. I appreciate trying to be secretive, but when everybody knows it's Khan and you're saying it's not, I mean, just give it up. Come on.
What's the point? What's the point? Doesn't matter to the characters in the film anyway.
Exactly.
Sheesh. It's a whole,
I still love that movie though.
I very much like parts of it, and I have problems with other parts of it. And people will already have known that if our schedule is as expected as we are doing a Star Trek month coming up.
Excellent.
And we're going to take a look at Star Trek: The Wrath of Khan and Star Trek Into Darkness.
Beautiful.
And then we have also were planning on doing, I believe, A Voyage Home and the first reboot. Or maybe it was Undiscovered Country. I don't know. That could all be BS. It could have all not have panned out. And that's what we were planning anyway. So there you go. So is there anything else about AI?
I noticed some things this time that just show these little details that show how smart Spielberg is.
Ooh, please.
There's a moment in the Flesh Fair where the daughter finds Teddy, the daughter of one of the Flesh Fair directors, and she goes and gets the director to come down and look at this boy in the cage. And he's got this X-ray gun with him. And to make sure the audience knows what that is, he has a moment where the guy has to slap the back of it to get the batteries in. And the X-ray gun goes off when he's doing that and shows that his little girl, you can see a skeleton behind her face. So then he uses the X-ray gun on David and you see that it's a robot.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like this extra little bit of business that they worked in to make sure the audience understands what they're doing and without having to tell you what he's doing.
Mm.
And that's just it's a tiny little detail that most people aren't going to notice. But it shows how smart Spielberg is. It reminds me on a much smaller scale of how genius the Mr. DNA cartoon is in Jurassic Park.
Oh, sure.
And there's another moment. It's a character moment where Gigolo Joe and David, it's after the Flesh Fair, and they're in the woods. Well, how is Gigolo Joe, Gigolo Joe likes to do all these dance moves. But they're in the woods, so they shoot this one scene where there's puddles so that he can do his dance moves and it still sounds like tap dancing.
Yes.
So it's like a little smart bit of location work to keep the integrity of the character in a small moment.
Mm.
I mean, that's like next level shit. To think about the tiniest details like that. And The thing that if you have the Jurassic Park Blu-ray or DVD with all the bells and whistles on it, there's a special feature on there that's home movies from Spielberg's first meeting with the special effects team. And if you watch that, you will believe that Spielberg is the smartest filmmaker alive. He basically came up with everything in this one meeting.
Really?
With all these little details about how the dinosaurs should move. And little bits of business that end up becoming iconic visual effects moments in the movies. So if you have that at home, everybody, you got to watch that.
Interesting. I'll have to check that out. You know, that makes me think that we should do a Jurassic Park show.
Oh, twist my arm.
Especially with Jurassic World coming out next year.
Yes, we're going to see a trailer a week from today, I believe. Or no, I'm sorry. The recording is on Friday. The trailer is supposed to come out online on Thanksgiving Day. So there you go.
Huh, interesting. Yeah, I mean, I guess to wrap up my thoughts about AI is, you know, I was completely blown away the first time I watched it. I don't know that I completely grasped onto the whole the religion aspect the first mm-hmm. time around. I think when I watched it the second time, I was like, oh, wait a minute. You know, and I think that's what is so great about films, specifically ones that we've chosen to discuss, is that it rewards multiple viewings. It's not just I don't know that this really worked, and let's talk about why it did or didn't, but right. It's a film that, you know, you can look at it, and I'm such a sucker for multiple interpretations in a film, because, you know, of course, when I watch it, I think, well, clearly it's this.
Yeah.
You know, and then if I hear someone else say that it's something different, I'm like, what? What do you mean?
Hell are you talking about?
Yeah, like, how dare someone have a different opinion than I do? Yeah, I don't understand.
And your opinion might be totally different in 10 years. It's it's easy to think that there's one way to see a movie because I think a lot of people only see movies once.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'll never forget the movie Revolutionary Road from a few years ago.
Sure. That's been in the top 15 of my queue for like 2 years and I still get to see it.
It's this dark, dark.
Sam Mendes, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. It's a dark melodrama, but the night that I saw it in the theater, for that entire audience, it played like a black comedy.
Really?
And the whole place was laughing from start to finish. But the movie still worked for me. And I was like, I'd never read any review of it saying that it was like darkly funny in any way. So I was like, what an experience that was. Cause I watched it again. I'm like, why were we laughing at this? But, you know, it just shows, you know, these are pliable works of art that can be seen many ways.
Yeah, especially if you're in a theater.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, because you have that, I mean, that's the great and that's the shitty thing about watching a film with an audience is sometimes you get a bunch of dickholes in there and you're like, oh, just shut up, you know, or quit moving around or, quit making so much damn noise.
Right.
But, you know, at times, you know, it makes films like I remember watching the second Matrix film, and people were fucking loving it.
Oh, really?
And I was like, what? Like, I don't. All right, well this part doesn't look that good, but man, these people around me are just fucking eating it up. And I watched it again and was like, yeah, my initial thoughts were correct. I don't care for this as much.
Yeah, I'm definitely one who can go along with a crowd in a movie like on a big movie premiere.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are I saw The Grudge on opening night in a packed
with Sarah Michelle Gellar.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
I saw that on opening night in a packed, huge auditorium of teenagers that went apeshit. And I came out of it thinking that's the scariest movie I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Then you get it on video and you're like, oh. It's like, yes, the audience experience is a big part of movie going.
Yeah, that's very similar to when I watched The Ring. And I mean, in very pretty similar types of films.
Yeah.
Where, you know, I watched that in the theater and Samara is climbing out of the well and she's walking towards the screen and I'm squirming in my chair and people are making noises and they come through. She comes through the TV and I'm like, ah, fuck that. But people around me are like, oh my God, you know, and all like grown ass men are saying that. And I'm like, what the fuck? And you know, I watch it now and I'm like, ah, oh, shit, here comes that thing where she goes through the screen, this fucking movie. You know?
That's one of those movies I have consciously not wanted to watch again because I have such a perfect memory of it.
Oh, really?
I'm like, I know it's going to be one where if I watch it now, I'm like, this movie is stupid.
Yeah, like the parts of it, like I still am fairly affected by the student film aspects.
Yes.
You know, with the ladder and all that shit. Like that stuff, I'm like, man, that's creepy. I don't like that. You know, I don't know what this is, but I don't like it. And the Brian Cox stuff is always really good.
Oh yeah, right. Well, so I like he's that. The best.
So there you go. All right. Well, do you have anything else about AI before we move on?
Oh, if you'll indulge me for one more thing,
sure,
I just have to mention Stan Winston.
Oh yes,
who is one of the great unsung heroes of the last 30 years?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean this guy. He and his studio made puppets and animatronics that were so good that people don't even realize they're looking at puppets and animatronics. And they did all the robots in this. They did the puppet work for Teddy, which is amazing.
Oh, yeah. Teddy.
Teddy is not a CGI character in every shot of this movie. Most of the time, he's a practical on-set puppet.
Yeah, it's when he looks a little light is when I think he's a CG.
Yeah, you can tell the CG shot. Most of the effects work in this movie is still seamless today, but there are some definite CG shots that you can tell. But the stuff that looks great, it looks great because they're doing it for real on the set. And Stan Winston died of cancer a few years ago, and his studio's still going. The last big project that he actually worked on, I think, was the first Iron Man. And you know, they built a real animatronic T-Rex for Jurassic Park, you know,
like they were saying about Jurassic Park. I was looking up Jurassic World and they talked about how, you know, this is the first of these films without him being involved. Mm-hmm. And And it's always tough when it's like, that's kind of the guy that birthed those sort of, you know, the look. And so when you have another movie coming out next year, it's like, well, yeah, CG is great, but is it going to be really light looking dinosaurs climbing up walls and shit? Like,
yeah, exactly.
You know, it's just things have such a heft when it's a real presence.
Absolutely. And, his son, actually, Stan Winston's son, is one of the guys in Hobby's office in that opening scene with all the lost cast members and Agent Coulson, too. So
interesting.
So Spielberg gave him a little connection to the film, personal connection to the film, too.
What do you think Ken Leung is doing in this movie? Because he doesn't have a line. And he's like sixth or seventh billed.
Is he really? Yeah. I think he does have one line in the very first scene, I do wonder. Spielberg is not one to do deleted scenes.
Mm.
So I do wonder, I mean, usually I do wonder if there's a whole lot of Hobby stuff on the cutting room floor. Ken Leung was a known actor, like a character actor who'd been in a lot of stuff then. And April Grace is in those scenes, and she was kind of an up and coming character actor. She had a big part in Magnolia with Tom Cruise in that story. So I do kind of wonder if there's a lot of that stuff that either never got shot or is completely lost.
Yeah, it's crazy.
But to the better of the film, probably.
Oh, sure.
Like to make I said it more that, David's story.
Yeah, like I said, it's if I had any criticism for it, it's a little overstuffed for me at points to where I just want more out of it. And I think that, you know, you were talking about if this film would have came out now, I think it has at least another 15 minutes runtime if it came out now.
Yeah, probably. There is that. I mean, every movie's so goddamn long, which I do wonder if they feel if I've always assumed in the last probably 6 or 7 years or so, if that's because producers feel they have to give people their money's worth. Mm. You know, if you go to the theater and pay $13.50 to go see a 3D movie and it's only 85 minutes long, are you going to be pissed off?
Yeah.
Even though probably a lot of movies would be much better if they were only 85 minutes long. It's like that Amy Poehler movie that I just watched on Netflix, They Came Together.
Oh, They Came Together. We just did a show on this.
It's fantastic.
It's so fucking good.
I laughed my ass off at that movie, but before the credits roll, it's not even to 80 minutes. So I'm wondering if that's why it didn't get a wide release, just because like they were like, people are going to be pissed that they paid $13 to see a movie that's not even as long as a double episode of Breaking Bad. You know?
It is. That movie is so fucking funny.
Yes.
God damn it.
And I hated Wet Hot American Summer.
Oh, see, that's funny because I really like that. And so when I heard that it was the same guys, I was like, oh, yes, give me more of this.
Yeah.
And, you know, we talked about this on the show where we reviewed it, but Rachel is such a hater of romantic comedies. But she's seen a lot of them, you know.
Yes.
And so that's why I was like, oh, we are definitely doing this for spoofs because you are going to love it. And so she and I both ate it up to where Anel, who isn't a fan of the genre at all, she was watching it and was like, yeah, I get that it's funny, but I don't, you know, it's like, okay.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like, no, it's because of this, and every romantic comedy does that, and the basketball scene is so good, and this and that. And the guy shitting his pants.
Basketball scene.
Yeah. You know, that and Christopher Maloney, who I don't know what his deal is, but I think that he's great that he's so ridiculous in David Wayne films. And then in everything else, he's so serious, it seems like.
Yeah, that guy, I always get the impression that he has to do those comedy jobs to stay sane. Because, I mean, if I worked on SVU for all those years, I'd probably be fucked up, too.
Yeah.
I don't know. I kind of worry for Mariska Hargitay's well-being when she gets to the end of that show after however many years it's going to be.
Right. And so I just thought, and you know, to have him shit his pants and then a story about how, you know, someone else had obviously put on his costume and then shit their pants and then tried to frame him. And it's just so ridiculous and so good. Just really, really makes me laugh.
And it's good to see a spoof that's actually funny in the age of the Seltzer Friedberg movies.
Yeah, you know,
I hate even to call those movies.
Yeah, and you know, this is going to come out long past when we did the spoofs, which is, you know, coming out now as we record. But we're doing you know, the good ones, for lack of a better term. You know, we're doing We're going to do Naked Gun. We're going to do, you know, I'm sure Rachel is going to pick Airplane. You know, we're going to do like the actual spoofs of films.
Excellent. And not just like, hey, remember that scene from that movie that you liked 9 months ago?
Yes. Remember Scary Movie. Remember fucking Date Movie or whatever that was called.
Good God.
Yeah, just ridiculous. All right. Well, if you have any comments, suggestions, or movies that you'd want to hear us talk about specifically for Podshots, you could email us at plainlabelpodcast@gmail.com. You could follow the show over at Twitter under the handle @plainlabelpod, where you could follow me. I'm @ericwilliams79. We also have a Facebook page where you could like the show. Just search for Plain Label Podcast. If you wanted to help us out a little bit, you could head over to Amazon.com and you could search for our wish list. It is not surprisingly called Plain Label Podcast. It's full of movies that we want, equipment that we need, and a whole host of other goodies if you're in the giving mood. So once again, just search for the wish list called Plain Label Podcast. I do want to thank Sean again for coming on and discussing the film with me. A little bit shorter recording time for us. It's not 12 hours. If people wanted to hear more from you, they could check out our previous discussions on The Fountain, Cloud Atlas, Sunshine, Prometheus, Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers, and of course, as we've been mentioning, the entire 6 seasons of Lost. But if they wanted to hear more from you specifically or get in contact with you, where could they do so?
Well, for ramblings about pop culture and the Disney theme parks, yes, I know, is you can follow me @AngryDisneyNerd. And if you're in the Chicago area, I also have my work account @SeanStanglandDH, where I talk about Chicago sports and give you the best stories from the Daily Herald in the Northwest suburbs.
So there you go. Well, thank you for listening, and we'll be back in 2 weeks with another co-host and another film.